Good morning. So good to be out. Good to have many with us that have been out sick. I'm very grateful to have my whole family here for the first time in a few weeks. But we miss those who are still sick at home at this time as well. I invite you to take a Bible out if you don't have one out already and follow along just to make sure again that everything that I say is true and in accordance with God's Word. Today's lesson is titled, Be Wise Small. That should sound familiar to the men here of the congregation. That's the title of the book we've used for the men's study on the first Saturday of each month throughout the year. Be Wise Small, the book, was written by Brother D. Bowman, very well-known gospel preacher who just passed away in the last couple of years, I believe. He preached down in Texas for over 50 years. I want to share this idea with everyone because the idea of Be Wise Small is just very practical. And it's a great approach just in life to help us bring more glory to God in all the ways that we can. To explain what this idea means, I want to read a little bit from Brother Bowman's introduction of the book. He says, Be wise small may sound a bit off key, but don't be fooled by its simplicity. It's an attribute and attitude that should be started early and then practiced in every area of life. I used to make several New Year's resolutions every January, and then promptly break most of them before the first month was held. But then I came up with one simple resolution. It was to be wise small. Now, after several years, I'm still working on that same simple little resolution. It's been an interesting and profitable journey. And he goes on to give very basic examples, like when you miss the trash can, what do you do? Do you pick the trash up and put it in the trash can where it belongs, or do you leave it until someone else comes along to pick up your mess after you? And that might seem like a natural thing that hopefully we don't struggle with, but I'll tell you, from my time working in an elementary school, that is not a natural human quality to pick up the trash when it's missed from the trash can, right? Kids will just walk right on by and leave it for the janitor or someone else. I like the example of the grocery cart. When you get your groceries into your car, do you put the cart where it belongs? And then maybe more than that, if you see another cart nearby that's not where it belongs, do you return that shopping cart to the proper corral or inside the front door or wherever the case may be? It's a pretty simple thing to do. There's no consequence if you don't do it, though, right? And so a lot of people neglect it. Bowman goes on to say, I concluded that if you continue to be wise about even the smallest matters, you will soon develop a habit. Then when the time comes, you will be wise about the large matters, almost habitually. And so, be wise small. And so that's the idea behind this, is that it's building a habit of making wise choices. And so I want to look at the example of Joseph. If you'll turn back to Genesis chapter 41. Genesis 41. You know, be wise small is a very simple idea with vast application. You could study the whole book of Proverbs with this idea. You could look at character studies of, you know, Hebrews of the Bible. But after a year of going through this book, I think Joseph might be my favorite example of what this looks like in someone's life. How being wise even in the smallest of matters. So be wise small like Joseph. Joseph experienced a lot in his life. We went through a study of Joseph almost 2 years ago here now. In case you don't remember or if you weren't with us at that time, Joseph was the favorite son of Jacob, right? He was the favorite son. Jacob doted on him. He gave him the coat of many colors. Jacob is this is the same man that God would change his name to Israel. Right? So he was the father of the Israel nation. He was descended from Abraham, right? Jacob would have been Abraham's grandson. Joseph was Abraham's great-grandson. And so he got preferential treatment, and that made his brothers very jealous. They didn't like it. So a lot of them wanted to kill Joseph, but they end up throwing him in a pit and selling him to some Midianite slave traders, right? And so he gets sold into slavery and taken to Egypt. And while he's in Egypt, he becomes a servant of Potiphar, a man of well-to-do man. He's the captain of the guard. Potiphar trusted Joseph, put him in charge over his household. And then, of course, as we know, Potiphar's wife makes some advances on Joseph that Joseph rejects. And eventually, Potiphar's wife tries to force Joseph to lie with her. He runs off, and so Potiphar's wife lies about Joseph and says he tried to force himself on her. And this gets Joseph thrown into prison, right? He's innocent, but he ends up in prison because of Potiphar's wife's claims. He spends a few years in prison until eventually Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, has some strange visions. And he ends up asking Joseph to interpret these visions. And Joseph, by the power of God, is able to tell Joseph what his dreams mean. And so Pharaoh then, because he interprets these dreams, Pharaoh makes Joseph second in command in Egypt. Look over in, if you're in Genesis 41, start in verse 38. Genesis 41 and verse 38. Because Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God?" Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has shown you all this, there is none so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards the throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." Pharaoh took a signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand and clothed him in garments of fine linen, put a little chain about his neck. He made him ride in a second chariot, and they called out before him, "Bow the knee." Thus he set him over all the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no one shall lift up hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." And so we see Joseph become very, very powerful, all right? Pharaoh acknowledges, "No one is wise like you are, Joseph." So what does this have to do with being wise small? Because becoming second in command in Egypt sounds like a pretty big deal, right? This is a pretty big thing going on. But to understand what this has to do with being wise small, we have to get to the bottom of this question of how did Joseph become the second in command over Egypt. I gave you a very brief, abbreviated bullet point summary of how Joseph got there, right? But that doesn't tell us the complete story. How is it he became second in command in Egypt under Pharaoh? Of course, there's more than one right answer to this. The first and most important answer is because of God. We see God's plan at work, and the Lord is with Joseph, and so it's through the providence of God, yeah, that Joseph is able to gain this power. It's through God's providence, it's through God's power that Joseph is able to interpret the dreams of Pharaoh, right? And so it's only by the power of God. We acknowledge that. But Joseph is also, he's not a puppet on a string, is he? He has free will, just like you and I have free will. And so God's plan is not limited to Joseph. If Joseph wanted to be a knucklehead and make stupid choices, well, God could have used somebody else to accomplish his plan. Joseph is not a puppet on a string. So why Joseph? Why is he the one in this position? Well, because he interprets Pharaoh's dream. Right? That's the reasoning that Pharaoh gives. Nobody else could interpret this dream. No one else is as wise as you are and has the Spirit of God. And so that's why he puts Joseph second in command. But that, I don't know if that gets to the bottom of our question. I think that brings up another question. How is it that Joseph, this Hebrew slave, and not just a Hebrew slave that's in prison at the time, how does he find himself in the position to interpret Pharaoh's dream in the first place? That's kind of strange, isn't it? When you stop and think about this foreign, imprisoned slave being invited to help Pharaoh. That's pretty odd when you stop and think about it. Well, Joseph was asked to interpret Pharaoh's dream because Pharaoh's cupbearer told Pharaoh, "Hey, I know a guy who might be able to help." It was Pharaoh's cupbearer that recommends Joseph to Pharaoh. Because you see, the cupbearer happened to do a little time himself, didn't he? He did some jail time himself in the past. And in his time in prison, he got to know Joseph. And so it's after Pharaoh has already asked all of the wise men of Egypt for help interpreting this dream, and they're not able to do it, it's then when the cupbearer says, "Hey, I know a guy." Now you back up to verse 8, Genesis 41, verse 8. So in the morning, his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was none who could interpret them to Pharaoh. Down to verse 10, when Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me in the chief baker. This is the cupbearer speaking now, sorry. The cupbearer speaking in verse 10. When Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me and the chief baker in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, we dreamed on the same night, he and I, each having a dream with its own interpretation. A young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. When we told him, he interpreted our dreams to us, giving an interpretation to each man according to his dream. And so it's at the cupbearer's prompting that Pharaoh sends for Joseph to interpret his dream. Verse 14 and 15, Pharaoh sent and called Joseph. And they quickly brought him out of the pit. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came in before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I've had a dream. There's no one who can interpret it. I've heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Okay, so Pharaoh asks Joseph because the cupbearer says, I know a guy who can interpret your dream. But why is it the cupbearer knows this? Why did the cupbearer tell Joseph about his dream, right? How does he know that Joseph can interpret dreams? And just think about your own life. Do you go around sharing your dreams with everyone? I mean, your literal, you know, when you have a dream at night, do you just go around sharing those with random people? Do you go around telling everybody about what you dream and asking them to tell you what it means? Right? We know that the cupbearer and Joseph knew each other from their time in prison. But even that, they come from very different backgrounds. The cupbearer was a servant to Pharaoh. He was responsible, in part at least, for Pharaoh's safety and making sure that none of the food that was brought to him was poisoned. You don't trust just a random slave with that job. And so he would have been very trusted by the most powerful man in the world. And then again, you have Joseph, a foreign slave. Who does he know in Egypt, right? His own brothers didn't want him. And so you have two guys coming from pretty different positions in life. So why would the cupbearer tell this foreign slave his dream? Well, you back up to Genesis 40. Look at verses 5 through 8. Genesis 40, verses 5 through 8. It says, one night, they both dreamed, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, each his own dream, and each dream with its own interpretation. When Joseph came to them in the morning, he saw that they were troubled. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in custody in his master's house, why are your faces downcast today? They said to him, we have had dreams, and there is no one to interpret them. And Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me. So Joseph notices that the cupbearer and the baker are downcast. He sees they're upset. Something's wrong. And he asks them, hey, what's wrong? What's going on? You don't normally look like this. What's going on? You might call that kindness, compassion, right? And so think about what that means for a second. Joseph's simple act of kindness to this fellow prisoner, this cupbearer, sets in motion a chain of events that ends with Joseph becoming second in command in Egypt under Pharaoh. How did Joseph become second in command? Because Joseph was kind, right? Because he was kind. And out of his kindness, out of his compassion, he asks the cupbearer, what's wrong? I know, that's not the only answer, right? It's a complex answer. But that's the moment where the cupbearer learns, hey, this guy can interpret dreams. And he's right about it, because it came true. And so when Pharaoh has a dream, cupbearer says, hey, I know a guy. Well, why did he know a guy? Because Joseph interpreted his dreams. And so he comes and interprets Pharaoh's dreams. But it all starts back with Joseph's very small act of kindness. and asking someone, what's wrong? Why are you troubled? Think back to what Mr. Bowman wrote in his introduction that I read earlier. He said, if you continue to be wise about even the smallest matters, you will soon develop a habit that when the time comes, you will be wise about the large matters almost habitually. Joseph's wisdom is not demonstrated in the fact that he can interpret dreams, and that was the power of God. Joseph's wisdom was demonstrated when he shows kindness and when he shows compassion. And what you see is Joseph has developed a habit of compassion, a habit of caring for other people, a habit of not throwing a pity party for himself and the situation, the negative circumstances he's found himself in, but showing compassion on others. And as Joseph's story continues to unfold in the next few chapters, you're going to see he needs that compassion in future events, doesn't he? It's that compassion that helps him deal with this global famine and helps him save countless lives because of his management of the food. It's his compassion that would help him make amends with his brothers and unite the sons of Jacob that leads to the growing of this Israelite nation in Egypt, right? His compassion would come in handy several times throughout his life. And so I think this teaches us something about wisdom. If we go back to this idea of be wise small, wisdom is a choice. Wisdom is a choice. Go over to James. We'll come back to Genesis a little bit later, but we're going to spend most of the rest of our lesson in James chapter 3, where Brother Charles read for us a little earlier. I think it's common to think of wisdom as like this quality that just kind of exudes from a person, right? You know a wise person, it's just everything about them just seems, you get like this Obi-Wan Kenobi or Gandalf-like figure in your mind, right? This wizarding type or grandpa type of character, where just everything they say is just insightful and probably witty at times. And we have this caricature of what a wise person is supposed to look like or sound like, and everything's just right on point. But when it comes to true wisdom, when it comes to biblical wisdom, talk is cheap. Yeah, you can say wise things, you should say wise things, and you can say foolish things, but talk alone is cheap. What makes a person wise? A person is wise because they make wise choices. Because they make wise choices. Actions reveal wisdom. A wise person makes wise choices regardless if it's a big choice or a little choice, however you want to define big or little, right? So that's why if you want to be wise, it's important to be wise small. Character traits like compassion and gentleness, those things are wise. James talks about this in James 3. Look at verse 13. Who is wise and understanding among you? By his good conduct, let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. The evidence of wisdom is seen in your, what does James say? In your conduct. That's the choices that you make. He goes on to describe the wisdom of the world in verses 14 through 16. The demonic wisdom, as he calls it. And what you see in verse 14 through 16 is the wisdom of the world is marked by jealousy and selfishness. Okay? You can be a pretty smart, intelligent person, but be jealous and selfish in your actions. And that makes you a fool. Okay? He describes godly wisdom again in verse 17. He says, but the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. And so godly wisdom, what's he say in verse 17? It's first what? What's your Bible say? It's first pure. So godly wisdom is much more concerned with morality than intelligence. It's more concerned with morality than just intelligence. That's not the way we often think of wisdom in our world. Godly wisdom, according to verse 17, is to be sincere, as the ESV says. The Greek word means without hypocrisy. It's unhypocritical. It's not circumstantial wisdom. I'm not wise in the big things and then foolish in the small things, right? Godly wisdom is about how we treat people, how you stand for the truth on a consistent basis. And that's exactly what Joseph demonstrated. We'll come back to James, but go back to Genesis 40. One more time with me, please. Genesis 40. I'm going to go back and look at that choice he made in verses 6 and 7. Because right along with wisdom, compassion is a choice, right? Compassion is a wise choice. Look at Genesis 40 and verse 6. When Joseph came to them, it's the cupbearer and the baker, in the morning, he saw that they were troubled. Okay, so what's he do? Verse 7. He asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in custody in his master's house, "Why are your faces downcast today?" How easy would it have been for Joseph to keep his mouth closed? How often do we see someone who's upset or troubled, and we just kind of, you know, we make a little bit wider path around them because I don't want to get involved. I can tell something's going on, but I don't want to know about it. I've got my own issues today. And so we don't say anything. Joseph did not have to say anything in that moment. He didn't have to do or say anything. But he did. Joseph made the wise choice. He speaks up and he asks, "What's wrong?" And as we know, that would lead to a chain of events that would change the course of history. Don't underestimate the impact of small, wise decisions. Don't ever underestimate what might come from one small, wise choice. Back at verse 6 again. And again, just put yourself in that position of when you notice someone is troubled. How many of us do that? We might not notice everyone. You're going through the store and you can't, you know, you don't know those people, but your workplace or a place, you know, the gym or wherever you're going, and you see these people all the time. You know, right? You know when someone just looks off. You can tell when something's going on with that person today. You might be more naturally gifted at that than others, perhaps, you know, and you can pick up on things easier than some, maybe, but I think this can be a learned skill. I think this is just about paying attention to people. When it's someone we spend a lot of time around, we can usually notice when something's going on with that person. Now, it may not be easy. It certainly might not be comfortable for you. Maybe it is, but maybe it's not to do what Joseph did, but we can all do what Joseph did. Whether it's easy or comfortable isn't the point. We can all ask that person, "What's wrong? Is everything okay?" But how often do we do what Joseph did in verse 7? How often do we speak up? And do we say the thing that maybe we'd rather not say? Because again, we don't want to deal with it. It might take time. Yeah, it might take time. It might take some effort. It might take some energy. It might take some awkward conversations on your part, and who knows what else. But isn't that a very negative way to view this opportunity? Looking at all the things it's going to cost you, all the things we don't want to deal with, that's a pretty negative way to look at it. It's also a selfish way to look at it. And what does James 3 say about selfish thinking? That's demonic wisdom. That's not wisdom from above. When we're thinking selfishly, we are not being wise. We're exercising the wisdom of the world, the wisdom of Satan, not the wisdom that comes from God. Selflessness is required for compassion and even for wisdom. Instead of being selfish, instead of dwelling on the negative possibilities, think about the potential good that can come from that. Think about how you might be able to help that person. And it might be something, again, small. It might not be something very big for that person. But you never know what might come from that. Compassion is a wise choice. And Joseph shows us that. Humility is also a wise choice. And we see this from Joseph over and over. And again, this is not just an innate, inherent quality in a person. Humility takes practice, and it's expressed again through actions a person either does or does not do. All throughout Joseph's life, he demonstrates humility. He has a lot of success. He's got a lot of ups and downs in his life, right? But no matter where he's at, if he's in at a peak or a valley, he's always giving credit to God. In Genesis 40, before he interprets the cupbearer and the baker's dreams, he says, do not interpretations belong to God? He gives God the credit and the glory. When he gets the chance to interpret Pharaoh's dream, verse 16, Joseph answered Pharaoh, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. And after Pharaoh tells him the dream, verse 25, Joseph said to Pharaoh, the dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. Even much later in life, when he's still in power and his brothers come to him, look at chapter 45. His brothers come looking for food from the land of Canaan. Genesis 45, verse 7 through 9, so Joseph speaking, he says, God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. And so notice in those examples, it doesn't matter what position of life Joseph is in. It doesn't matter if he's inferior to the people he's talking to or if he's superior to the people he's talking to. Right? Whether he's a slave, whether he's in Pharaoh's house, a slave talking to Pharaoh, second in command, talking to his foreign brothers, right? It doesn't matter his station of life and the station of life of the other people he's talking to. He always makes sure to acknowledge God and God's power and God's role in everything that's taking place. Wisdom is a choice. Humility is a choice. Go back to James 3 again. I'm going to go through verses 17 through 18. Mainly verse 17. James 3:17. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. Again, the first characteristic of wisdom is purity. A wise person makes choices that are pure. And again, it's true in the bigger, the small matters. Public life, personal life, when no one's looking behind a closed door, a wise person makes pure choices. You are lying to yourself if you think you are wise, but you're making immoral decisions. It's not true. It's not me, that's what James says. Wisdom from above is first pure. There are some interesting literary things going on in verse 17 in the original Greek that don't translate into the English. But the next three characteristics all have alliteration in the Greek, and they all kind of rhyme. And so they're kind of grouped together, these next three. And this describes the attitude of a wise person. A wise person is peaceable. He's gentle. He's open to reason. Those also kind of work together as kind of a definition of meekness. Verse 13 talks about meekness. Right? Well, what is meekness? This is meekness. It's being peaceable, gentle, and open to reason. It's not at all about being weak, right? There's a lot of strength involved in meekness. But it's exercising that strength in a peaceable, gentle, and open way. So there's an attitude that goes along with being a wise person. But then, of course, there's actions that have to be involved. The next set of qualities, I think they rhyme also, but they full of mercy and good fruits. If you are not merciful in your actions, if you're not bearing good fruit, well, then again, you're not a wise person. And isn't this a great description of Joseph and his actions? Wasn't Joseph full of mercy? Wasn't he bearing good fruit throughout it, no matter where he was? Even again, when things were not going his way, when he was unjustly punished, he still continued to bear good fruit. He was wise. Wisdom is not just about knowing. It's also about working. And the final two words also rhyme and have alliteration in the Greek. The ESV says impartial and sincere. New American Standard says unwavering and without hypocrisy. And the point is, Christians are to be consistent. It's about consistency. God is not pleased by fake faith. And there's not much that harms the church more than hypocritical choices by Christians. Because when people see that, they say, oh, you don't really mean it, right? They look at that as a mark against Christianity, against God, when they see our hypocritical choice. And we're not going to be perfect. And there's a place to share that with people. Hey, yeah, I'm not perfect. I was wrong there. We can't knowingly go about making unwise choices and claim to be wise, right? There's no excuse for hypocrisy. Your actions and your attitude, they have to line up. And again, it needs to be in the big and the small. That's where consistency comes in. Wisdom requires us to be consistently wise. If you're not consistently wise, then you're not really all that wise. And so if you take a step back and you think about all the decisions we have to make in life, right? I mean, who you're going to marry, where you're going to live, what job you're going to take on, right? Where you're going to worship at, how are you going to raise your kids? How are you going to resolve arguments in your household? Right? How are you going to school? Are you going to send your kids to public school, private school? You're going to homeschool? Do both mom and dad, do they both have to work? These types of questions. How are you going to manage your money? When are you going to be able to retire? You need to buy a bigger home? You need to downsize? There are lots of big choices that really stress us out. And those are all important choices. But if you want to be wise about the big things, you have to be wise about the small things first. You have to develop this habit of making wise choices. It starts with purity. It involves having the right attitude that lead to the right actions. And has to be consistent. We have to show compassion to everyone in life. We have to pick up the trash when we miss the trash can. Right? We have to return the shopping cart. We have to say I love you to the people that we love in our life. Right? The little things. Impartial and sincere wisdom chooses to be wise about even the smallest of matters. If you think about this, there's no wiser choice than we can make than to devote your life to Christ, right? No wiser choice you're ever going to make than to devote your life to Jesus Christ. All other wisdom in the world is useless without faithful obedience to God. If you have never made that choice to become a child of God, if you've never put on Christ in baptism and had your sins washed away by the blood of Christ in baptism, you can choose to make that choice today. Mentioned D. Bowman earlier. He's known for saying at the end of his sermons, if you miss heaven, you've just missed all there is. And how true is that? If you miss heaven, you miss all there is. Maybe you are a child of God, but you know you've been making some foolish choices. You've not been making pure choices. Maybe your attitude, your action, something is not the way that God wants you to be living. Make the choice to get right with him. We're here for you. We're here to encourage you. If we can be of any encouragement to you or help you in any way, please let us know as we stand and sing.